There is something delicious about writing the first words of a story. Perhaps the anonymous writer picked by God to pen the words of Esther's thought something similar to Renee Zellweger's opening line in the movie Miss Potter, which, by the way, is a charming and delightful film about the creator of Peter Rabbit that the whole family will enjoy. Beth Moore, in her study of Esther, comments, "At first glance, the Genesis words to Esther's story don't seem delicious at all, not even noteworthy. Quote, this is what happened. So what? But although it seems perfectly natural to open a narrative in this manner, it is actually rare. Biblical narratives commonly begin with it happened, but omit in the days of. On the other hand, prophetic writings are often introduced as having occurred in the days of King whoever. But the book of Esther unfolds, however, with the two intertwining, and the result, according to some scholars, is an opening more like the opening of a folk tale, with the aura of once upon a time in the days of King Ahasuerus, king of the vast Persian Empire. Esther resembles the opening of a folk tale because it tells such a great and true story. Indeed, the result is God's love, and God's great love of a great story is extravagantly evident in the narrative that makes up the opening of over 40% of the Bible. Esther 1 is where we are. Esther 1:1 reads, "This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Ethiopia." So let's begin by getting further acquainted with King Xerxes. His Persian name was Khashayarshan. Try that. Khashayarshan. Well, in Hebrew, it's Ahasuerus, and in the Greek language, Xerxes. His father was Darius I, and his grandfather was Cyrus the Great. So he came from a very illustrious family. And like most monarchs of his day, Xerxes was a proud man. And in this first chapter, we see at least three evidences of his pride. We see his boastfulness in verses 1 through 9. We see his drunkenness in verses 10 through 12. And his vindictiveness in verses 13 to 22. After introducing the book of Esther last Sunday, Diana and I decided to watch the DVD version of the story, One Night with the King. And it's very well done. And I came away actually feeling a little better about King Xerxes than I had depicted him in the morning message. But nevertheless, Warren Wiersbe, in his book Be Committed, points out that Eastern rulers enjoyed having lavish banquets on each occasion that gave them opportunity to display their wealth and their power. Three banquets are mentioned in this first chapter alone. One for the key military and political offices of the empire, verses 1 through 4. One for the men of Susa, verses 5 and 8, which was the site of the king's winter palace. And one for Queen Vashti, for the women of Susa, that in verse 9 was presided by her. And here's the way the story begins. Chapter 1, verse 3. "In the third year of his reign, Xerxes gave a banquet for all the nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media. The princes and the nobles of the provinces were present." Max Lucado, "Tough times trigger poor decisions. We lose our bearings. We forget God's call. We exchange our convictions for the bright lights of Persia. And this was the temptation that faced the Jews." Xerxes' excuse for having this lavish event was to convince Persian nobles and officials and princes and governors and military leaders to support his campaign against the Greeks. The citadel, his seat of power, was immense. It was visible for miles. It towered over the city. And its immensity sent a message that in these halls sat an important king. Hear ye him. Xerxes was 35 years of age and rich beyond imagination. His palace boasted hangings of white and blue linen. In verse 6, couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and costly stones. The palace hall had 36 columns that stood 70 feet tall. Each column was crowned with sculptures of twin bulls, which supported the immense wooden timbers of the ceiling. Even the pavements were works of art. When Alexander the Great entered the palace, when he came to Susa a century later, he discovered in today's dollars the equivalent of 54 billion in bullion, 270 tons of minted gold coins. Xerxes was certainly not hurting for any cash, and he promised wealth and reward to all of his willing warriors. And to make proof that he could make good on his promise, he staged a six-month Vegas extravaganza. Verses 4 and 5, for a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and the glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. So it was a Mardi Gras of drinking and dining and guests from 100 posts in different ports, officials and power brokers. Wannabes mingled and they schmoozed and indulged. Feasts on a dozen tables. Wine was like water. Everyone imbibed as much as they desired and then drank some more. 6 months of fine food and excess and who's who and Pinot Noir, and Xerxes presided over the whole event. But toward the end of the carnival, the king's true colors began to show through. In his 187th day of feasting, when he was, as verse 10 describes, in high spirits from wine, he sent for Queen Vashti. A bit tipsy, Xerxes decided to show off his wife. As you know, she was lovely to look at, describes verse 11. And apparently he expected her to dance in front of his frat friends and leave them entranced in a cloud of perfume. According to the Midrash, an ancient commentary on Esther, Xerxes told his queen to enter the room wearing nothing but a crown. That detail can't be verified, but this much is for sure. He did not invite Vashti in order to get her opinion on matters of state. He wanted to flaunt her in front of his poker pals. Persia was not a very safe place for women. Females, including the king, the queen, were considered property. Vashti spent most of her time cloistered in some corner, being pampered and praying for her next appearance with the king. She was an accoutrement, nothing more, you know, a trophy in his case. Her only function was to make Xerxes look potent and important. And boy, was he in for a surprise. She refused to comply. Prance about in front of a bunch of intoxicated men? No, thank you. Good for you, Vashti. The king became furious, burned with anger, verse 12. Big, strong, billionaire Xerxes, ruler of 127 provinces, mighty overlord who controlled the world. he was undone by his wife. He'd spent 6 months whining and dining and flexing his muscles. Yet on the last night, he was made to look rather mamby-pamby in front of all his drunken buddies. And when the ruler showed off, his incompetency showed up. He assembled his seven barely sober writers and advisors and said, what am I supposed to do? Verse 13, then the king said to the wise men who understood the times. Just an aside from Charles Stanley. You and I are wise to make the effort to understand the times, to gain an accurate picture of how people of our era tend to think and behave and communicate, because then we can have a maximum impact on our culture for Christ. At this time, wiser consultants would have urged the king to settle the matter in private. They would have reminded the king that perhaps 6 months of whining had sort of made his mind foggy, would have suggested that he let his brain clear a little bit. But Xerxes was blessed with cabinet members who were seemingly as dense and drunk as he was, and they huddled and strategized. And then they gave this bizarre report that you find in verses 16 and 17. Queen Vashti has done wrong. Not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all women, and they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. Max again. I smell fear in those words. Fellers, we've got to act. Something's got to be done. If not, the world might spin off its axis. Women will begin thinking for themselves. Men will need to be kind to their wives. Daughters will envision a life outside of the kitchen. How to avoid such a tragedy? Banish Vashti. Verses 19 and 20. So let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. And let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all the vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest. Where did these guys come from? Were they really so blind and so arrogant, so out of touch with human nature, that they thought an edict would engender the women, their devotion? These are men who were overseeing the running of a vast empire. And Xerxes' display of importance, all his party and possessions and power, became Xerxes' display of ignorance, temper, indecisiveness, folly. For all of his strut and swagger, Xerxes was nothing more than a chump. Do you see the irony? Do you shake your head and sort of roll your eyes at Xerxes' response to Vashti? Question. What if the glitz and glamour of Persia and the world around us is a farce, only folly? What if all the lure of lights that we see is a hoax? All of the red carpets, all the social media, all the Twitter, all the fancy parties, invitation-only clubs? What if all the hoop-de-doo and la-di-da is just one big folly? I've chased some of it, but don't fall for it. Don't buy the line. Don't buy the bluff. Don't, as Max says, don't get cozy in Persia. you and I need to stay faithful to our call as a covenant people. Let's widen our lens for a bit of context, and let's look at a little bit of Hebrew history. When God called Abraham out of Ur, he made a covenant, a promise, that Abraham would be the father of a holy nation. Quote, in Genesis 12:3, I will bless those who bless thee. I will place a curse on those who harm you, and all the people of the earth will be blessed through you. And exactly how would God bless the world through Israel? Well, first they would model a way of living that reflected the glory and the goodness of God. And unlike the depraved, promiscuous, violent Canaanites who surrounded them, they would worship their maker. They would love their neighbors. They would honor their families. And second, they would provide a lineage through which Jesus Christ, who was the world's greatest global blessing, could be born. The children of Israel were the caretakers and were the caretakers and curators of God's covenant to Abraham. For this reason, they were to remain separate. They were to remain different, holy, set apart. They were not permitted to marry non-Jews or worship pagan deities or embrace the pagan culture. They had two very distinct ways to worship, to live, to love. Did they succeed at being separate? Sometimes marvelously so. Think Joshua inheriting the promised land. Sometimes miserably, no. Think of the long line of corrupt kings, each more wicked than the prior one. And eventually, people so forgot their God that he used exile to get their attention. 586 BC, the Babylonians sacked Jerusalem, deported about 10,000 of the city's elite. And then in 539 BC, the Persians sacked the Babylonians. And by the time we meet Mordecai and Esther, the Jews were three generations and more than 1,000 miles removed from their days in Jerusalem. It's hard to imagine that even some of them could recall their days in the homeland. They were encircled by Persians. They daily heard the footsteps of the soldiers, the wheels of the chariots. Merchants did business with non-Jews. Farmers sold their produce to Persians. They lived among the opulent wealth and the fragrant temples of foreign people. What's more, the truly zealous Jews had taken the opportunity to return to Jerusalem, either with Zerubbabel or with Ezra. And the Jews who remained in Persia chose to remain in Persia. Exile had been kind to them. They had good jobs and secure positions, and some were more Persian than they were Hebrew. To enjoy the success and the wealth of the people in Susa, all they had to do was just simply play their cards right and abide by the rules and just fade into the fabric of the Persian culture. Unlike other books of the Old Testament that describe the Jews settling and settled in the Promised Land, the book of Esther depicts a people who are distant from their land. Jerusalem was so far away, and Persia was so relevant, so lush, so inviting. And the point of this first chapter of Esther is simply this: Persia, the world is lying to you. Do you and I need the same reminder? The assignment that was given to the Jews was passed on to you and I. God displays his glory and goodness through the church. And as we worship God, love our neighbors, cherish our families, we become billboards of God's message. We too are caretakers. caretakers of the message of Jesus. He was born through the lineage of the Jews, and today he is born through the lives of his saints. As you and I live out our faith, he's delivered into a faith-famished culture. You and I, we have the hope that the world needs, an unshakable hope. But sometimes we sort of forget our calling. We need this reminder that Persia is lying to us. Billion-dollar industries are conning you into luring you into lifestyles that will leave you wounded and worried. Example, try this lie. Pornography is a harmless expression of sexuality. Really? It's as addictive as drugs and alcohol. Brain scan science proves that. It changes the makeup of the brain. And what about the sex trafficking that it encourages? What about the violence it engenders? Yet the message that porn peddlers whisper to the unsuspecting is, it won't hurt, it's just sex. Liar. Or this, whoever dies with the most toys wins. Heard that one? You are what you own, so own all you can. Take on the liability, borrow the money. Saddle yourself with a budget-busting mortgage. It's worth it. In a study from January 12, 2021, 1 year ago, the average American household carries more than $145,000 in debt, and that includes nearly $7,000 of credit card debt alone. We worship stuff, hoping stuff will bring you like. But your Maker, he tells you the truth. It was the verses on this morning's Bible Gateway verse of the day, Matthew 6:19-20. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Here's another falsehood. A few drinks takes the edge off the day. What could be wrong? And according to the marketing machine behind the liquor industry, the answer would be nothing at all. Enjoy the high life, says Miller Beer. You know, find your beach, says Corona Extra. The happiest hour on earth, boasts Jameson Whiskey. A shot of adventure, claims Jose Cuervo Tequila. Yet underneath all of the slick advertising, there's an ugly underbelly of alcohol abuse. Excessive drinking takes its toll on bodies and health and mental, marriages, friendship, works, productivity, pregnancies. So says the CDC. The list of lies could go on and on. Deceptions about identity, race, pluralism. According to Physicians Weekly, depression is on the rise, especially during this COVID-19 pandemic. Divorce filings are up 34% year to year. Calls to mental health hotlines in the last year have increased 891%, CNN. The suicide rate is the highest it has been since World War II, Time magazine. In a survey last August 2020, 1 in 4 people ages 18 through 24 had seriously considered suicide in the 30 days prior to being surveyed. How do God's people live in a godless society? Do we blend in and just assimilate? Or do we stand out and stand up? Do we assist? We were made for this moment, just like Esther. You and I have a purpose right here, right now. Philippians 1:27, above all, you must live as citizens of heaven, conducting yourselves in a manner worthy of the good news about Christ, standing together in one spirit and one purpose, fighting together for the faith, which is the good news. Max Lucado shares this personal story. During my Boy Scout days, I earned a first aid merit badge. I could be counted on to wrap a sprained ankle or bandage a scraped knee. And during one of our day-long jamborees, I was assigned a spot to the first aid tent. Initially, I was thrilled. I wore a first aid armband. I stood under a first aid flag. I felt important. But as I stood outside and watched the activities, I began to feel left out. The other scouts were running and swimming and competing and playing, and Max, I was standing in front of a tent. I wanted to remove the armband and join in the fun. And then the scoutmaster said to me, "You have a special place here. You need to be different. This tent is a place for hurting kids." So I kept my post. Will you keep yours? Great verses, 1 Peter 2, 9 through 12. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So, dear friends, I urge you as foreigners and exiles to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that they, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. You were made for more than moody leaders and flashy parties. You were made to serve the Almighty God, to be a temple of the Holy Spirit. Persia offers nothing. Hollywood can't satisfy your needs. Madison Avenue makes its promises, but leaves people naked of hope. Godless living is no life to live. Will Mordecai and Esther see this? Cast in a story of decadence, will they resist the allure? Will they triumph? Faith or facade? The answer might not surprise you, but it might caution you. Heroes of the Bible don't always begin that way. Marvelously, as you and I spend the next 9 weeks with him, in the pages of Esther's story, God will write something new and unexpected of our own into his. Your personal story, written into God's epic annuals of human history, will be different because you choose to meet him in his word. When we trust our lives to the hand and to the pen of an unseen but ever-present God, he will write our lives into his story, and every last one of them will turn out to be a great read with a grand ending. Don't just wait and see. Live and see. Believe it. Selah.